Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident that's ultimately going to be studying radiology soon. This is episode 112 of the Divine Intervention podcast, and I am going to basically do round two of the Clutch Farm podcast. I will try to hopefully get all of it done today so that we don't have to go through round three, but we'll see how far I can go. So let's just jump right into it, right? So last time I talked about how you have alpha-1 agonists like phenylephrine or ephedrine, right? Remember, you can use those to treat like profound hypotension, like in the setting of like getting anesthesia and then the person gets hypotensive. Classically on NBMEs, those people get phenylephrine or ephedrine because those are alpha-1 agonists. And then remember your phenoxybenzamine and phentolamine. Remember, those are classically used in the setting of if a person has a pheochromocytoma, right, before they go for surgery. Remember, you want to block alpha receptors first before you block beta. So you can use the irreversible alpha-1 antagonist, phenoxybenzamine, or the reversible alpha-1 antagonist, phentolamine. I can already envisage how they could test that in the context of the Michaelis-Menten kinetics. And then don't forget your alpha-1 blockers, prazosin and doxazosin. Remember that those, they are used to treat a BPH in the short term. Remember, BPH long-term therapy is your 5-alpha reductase inhibitors like a finasteride, dutasteride. And remember that prazosin, doxazosin can cause orthostatic hypotension because they are not selective only for the alpha-1 receptors in the bladder neck. They also attack the alpha-1 receptors that you find in the bloodstream. For tamsulosin, right? Tamsulosin is what your go-to if you want to just block things in the bladder neck and not sort of cause like the weirdness with regards to hypotension with the alpha-1 blockers. And then alpha-methyl-DOPA is tested in the context of being one of the antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy, okay? Remember, alpha-methyl-DOPA is also associated with drug-induced lupus, and those are anti-histone antibodies. And then again, other antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy, like your hydralazine, your labetalol, your nifedipine, right? Remember, hydralazine can cause a reflex tachycardia. Remember, it's also associated with drug-induced lupus. Remember, labetalol is an alpha-beta blocker, right? Remember, classically, it's used for hypertensive emergencies on NBMEs. And then remember nifedipine as well. That's a dihydropyridine, a calcium channel blocker. I talked about clonidine last time. And again, remember, if a person comes in with a cocaine overdose, right, you want to avoid a beta blocker, right, so that you don't cause unopposed alpha stimulation. And then remember I talked about thyroid storm, how thyroid storm is at first you give propranolol, right, and then after that you give PTU, and then after that you can basically do whatever you want pretty much, but usually on NBMEs they go after propranolol first. That's the first drug you always want to give, and then you can give PTU afterwards. Remember, PTU can cause agranulocytosis, right, like the any other anti-thyroid medication. And then remember your beta 2 agonists, right? So like albuterol, classically on exams you use those for asthma. Remember, you use that as short-term like rescue therapy in asthma. And remember, you can also use albuterol for the treatment of hyperkalemia, right, because it increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So that's something that's tested quite frequently on exams. Albuterol is a short-acting beta 2 agonist. Don't forget that we have salmeterol, formoterol, those are LABAs, right? Those are long-acting beta agonists. Remember, before you institute a LABA in asthma, the first thing you do is, so you give a SABA first. If the SABA is not cutting it, you add an inhaled corticosteroid. If that's not cutting it, you add a LABA. Remember, never use a LABA as monotherapy. And then if that's not cutting it, that's where you go to like a PO steroids. And one high-yield thing to keep in mind is that a LABA can actually be substituted for like your leukotriene inhibitors like zafrelocast and montelocast, okay? So something to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember the beta 2 agonist, terbutaline, ritodrine, those are beta 2 agonists. You can actually use them as tocolytics if you want to delay pregnancy for a bit, okay? That's how they are tested on NBMEs. And then remember, if a person has anaphylactic shock, your drug of choice is epinephrine, right? Your drug of choice in anaphylactic shock is epinephrine. Contrast that with a septic shock where your drug of choice is norepinephrine. If a person has cardiogenic shock, you probably want to think more about an inotrope, right? So you want to use something like a dobutamine, which is a beta 1 agonist. Alternatively, you can use murinone. Murinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It ups your levels of cyclic AMP. Remember, cyclic AMP causes increased contractility in cardiac muscle, but it actually causes relaxation of smooth muscle. So basically, the thing that happens under those circumstances is you increase the cardiac output because it's a positive inotrope, right? Because it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor in all kinds of muscles. So you increase cardiac output, but you also decrease afterload because it's causing vasodilation of your blood vessels. Okay, because your blood vessels contain a smooth muscle. And then remember these drugs like bethanycol and carbachol, right? So bethanycol, carbachol, they are classically used on NBMEs for the treatment of you can either use them to treat like what is it called? Because they are muscarinic agonists, you can use them to treat you can use them to treat overflowing continence, right? Because again, in overflowing continence, your bladder muscles are not contracting like they should. So pretty much you just give those people something that's a muscarinic agonist. Remember, your parasympathetic system rest and digest, so that essentially encourages those people encourages those people's bladders to work so that you can pee. Alternatively, you can also use bethanycol in the treatment of like Ogilvy syndrome on NBMEs, where the person essentially has their let's say like post anesthesia, they have like massive colonic dilation with no real obstruction. You can give a muscarinic agonist like a bethanycol for those purposes. You can also use a carbachol, but bethanycol shows up more commonly on NBMEs. And then if a person has a glaucoma, right, one thing you can actually do is to give a muscarinic agonist to increase drainage through the canals of Schlemm, because if you give a muscarinic agonist, you'll cause meiosis, right? So you'll clench down on the pupils. And when you do that, you basically like open up the highway of the canal of Schlemm for drainage. So you can use drugs like pilocarpine for that. Remember, pilocarpine as a muscarinic receptor agonist is also used on NBMEs in the treatment of Sjogren's, right? So remember, Sjogren's, those people are not making enough like spit pretty much, right? So you can actually remember, by giving a muscarinic agonist, you encourage the production of saliva, right? So that sort of relieves some of their symptoms. And then don't forget your acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, right? So like neostigmine, pyridostigmine, physostigmine. So remember that you get rid of myasthenia or pyridostigmine, right? Because remember, in myasthenia, you have autoantibodies that are attacking the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor you find at the neuromuscular junction. So if you give an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, a long-acting acetylcholinesterase inhibitor like pyridostigmine, you will bump up the person's levels of acetylcholine, and those will outcompete those nasty antibodies that you're finding on the surfaces of those cells. And then neostigmine, again, acetylcholinesterase inhibitor bumps up your acetylcholine. You classically use it to treat ileus on NBMEs, right? So like Ogilvy syndrome, again, because neostigmine will bump up your acetylcholine and that will make your bowels move. Remember, your parasympathetic system makes you poop and makes you pee, okay? And then remember, you can use physostigmine to fix an atropine overdose, right? Because remember, if a person overdoses on atropine, atropine has muscarinic receptor blocking activity. So if you give physostigmine would inhibit acetylcholinesterase, your levels of acetylcholine will go up, and you can outcompete atropine on the muscarinic receptors. And then remember your acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil, galantamine, and rivastigmine. Remember, if a person has Alzheimer's, right, they have a destruction of the basal nucleus of Meynert. So if you destroy the basal nucleus of Meynert, right, you have an acetylcholine deficiency. Another way they can test that same thing is to say that people with Alzheimer's have decreased activity of choline acetyltransferase. So if you basically have an acetylcholine deficiency, you try to give a procholinergic agent in the treatment of Alzheimer's, and you can give the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors donepezil, galantamine, and rivastigmine for those purposes. And then remember your organophosphates, right? Remember, organophosphate poisoning, organophosphates, they are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, right? So they inhibit acetylcholinesterase. And the thing is, when they inhibit acetylcholinesterase, so this is essentially nerve gas. So organophosphate, nerve gas, same pathophysiology. They inhibit acetylcholinesterase, your levels of acetylcholine build up, and you have a cholinergic toxidrome. So they have a lot of like lacrimation, vomiting, diarrhea, sweating. They will have like pupillary meiosis. They will have bradycardia on an NBME exam, right? Because remember, acetylcholine, muscarinic receptor agonist, slows conduction down the AV node. So to treat organophosphate poisoning, obviously you want to give something that can reverse those cholinergic symptoms. So you can give a muscarinic receptor antagonist like atropine, but you can actually try to regenerate the acetylcholinesterase by giving a drug like a prelidoxin. Okay, and then methacholine is actually a drug that's used in as a provocative test for asthma, right? Because methacholine is a muscarinic receptor agonist. Okay, it's a muscarinic receptor agonist, so it can trigger It can trigger a bronchospasm. So the thing is, if you use very dilute concentrations on a normal individual, it doesn't cause any problems. But if you give it to a person that is bronchospastic or has like predilection for bronchospasm, like an asthmatic, that dilute concentration will cause a decrease in FEV1 by like more than like 20%. And then that helps you make your diagnosis of asthma. And then hydrofonium may show up on an MBME exam in the context of a diagnostic test for myasthenia gravis. Remember, hydrofonium is used in the tensilin test. It's a very short-acting acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, that's bad English. So basically, if you inhibit acetylcholinesterase with hydrofonium, you build up the levels of acetylcholine. When you build up the levels of acetylcholine, guess what happens? You transiently relieve the symptoms in myasthenia gravis. And then one other drug I want to talk about here is scopolamine. Scopolamine is an anticholinergic agent. It's very good for like motion sickness. That's literally all you need to know about it for an MBME exam. And then remember, if a person has something called urge incontinence, right? So they give it to you on an MBME as a person that essentially has they have like urinary urgency, or they can't get to the bathroom in time before they pee on themselves. They love to test this a ton on MBME exams, right? It means that their bladders are overactive, right? And the thing is, if a person has overactive bladder, remember I told you that your parasympathetic system encourages peeing and pooping. So if a person has overactive bladder, it means like their parasympathetic system is working too well. So you give a muscarinic receptor antagonist for those purposes, right? And on MBME is the classic muscarinic receptor antagonists that are used in the treatment of urge incontinence are these drugs. There's this mnemonic that I learned studying for step 1. It's called the on the darn toilet. So it's like O for oxybutynin, one, the T is for toteridine, the D is for darphenazine and sulfenazine, and then the other T is for trospium. Okay, so it's one of those high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then remember your ipratropium and the tiotropium. Those are muscarinic receptor antagonists. You use those in the treatment of asthma. You can also use those in the treatment of COPD. Although in general, if a person has COPD and an MBME is forcing you to pick between a SABA, right? So basically like albuterol or a SAMA, right? So a short-acting muscarinic antagonist, I would go more with the SAMA under those circumstances. Remember, ipratropium is short-acting. Tiotropium is longer-acting. And then midodrine, it's classically used to treat autonomic instability on MBMEs, right? Midodrine is essentially like a vasoconstrictor. You can use it to treat like orthostatic hypotension in people. That's pretty much all you need to know about it. Haloperidol, I already talked about it. Remember, it's a first generation typical antipsychotic. It prolongs the QT interval, right? Remember, it can cause hyperprolactinemia because you're effectively blocking the tuberoinfundibular pathway of dopamine. And remember that haloperidol, right, it can cause all those fancy-schmancy extrapyramidal symptoms. It's the most powerful first-generation typical antipsychotic. And then remember, if a person is taking isoniazid, right, remember isoniazid can cause it can cause a drug-induced lupus. So remember that with your antihistone antibodies. Remember, isoniazid also depletes your vitamin B6, right? So you basically have decreased activity of delta-aminolevulinic acid synthesis, which is one of the rate-limiting enzymes in heme synthesis. So those people can get a sideroblastic anemia. Remember, isoniazid, in addition, also has the ability to, again, by depleting B6, because, I mean, that's why doctors say if you're taking isoniazid, make sure that you take vitamin B6 or what's another name for vitamin B6? Pyridoxal phosphate alongside, because B6 is a cofactor for glutamate decarboxylase, which converts glutamate to GABA. So if you have a B6 deficiency because you're taking isoniazid, you accumulate glutamate and you deplete GABA, right? So you can have seizures. And then remember, isoniazid is nephrotoxic and hepatotoxic. The way I remember that is INH. Isoniazid is the I, N, it's neurotoxic, H, it's hepatotoxic. Okay, so that's another high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And again, remember, isoniazid is classically used to treat TB. And then remember your levodopa, carbidopa. Those are classically used to treat Parkinson's. Levodopa is a dopamine precursor, pretty much. Carbidopa is a dopa decarboxylase inhibitor. It basically prevents the peripheral breakdown of levodopa so that it can cross the blood-brain barrier, get into the brain, and then you can use it to treat You can use it to essentially treat Parkinsonian symptoms because you're boosting those people's dopamine. And then don't forget this drug, entacapone and tocapone. Those are COMT inhibitors, right? So they can test those on MBMEs for the treatment of Parkinson's, because COMT is an inhibitor of it breaks down dopamine, right? So if you give a COMT inhibitor, you have less dopamine breakdown, and you can potentially relieve the symptoms of Parkinson's. And then don't forget selegiline or sertraline. Those are your MAOB inhibitors, okay? They are monoamine oxidase inhibitors. You can actually use them to treat Parkinson's as well, because again, monoamine oxidase B breaks down dopamine. So if you inhibit MAOB, you don't break down dopamine, right? So you can fix symptoms of a Parkinson's. Although remember that these MAOB inhibitors, selegiline or sertraline, they are like your classic MAOIs that you find in psychiatry. You don't want to give those agents in people that are taking a tyramine or rich foods. And then amantadine can also be used for Parkinson's. It was previously used for influenza, but no one does that stuff anymore because there's essentially like 100% resistance. And then there are some dopamine agonists I kind of want to talk about, right? So don't forget pramipexole and ropinirole. Those are dopamine receptor agonists. They are classically used on MBMEs in the treatment of restless leg syndrome. Remember, restless leg syndrome has an association with iron deficiency anemia. So iron supplementation is also a classic thing that's tested on MBMEs. But yes, you can treat restless leg syndrome with a dopamine receptor agonist like pramipexole or ropinirole. Alternatively, you can use there is this barbiturate known as primidone. Primidone is a barbiturate that's classically used in the treatment of restless leg syndrome. And then your dopamine agonists like bromocriptine, cabergoline. Remember, you can use those to treat you can use those to treat a prolactinoma, right? Because remember, another name for dopamine is prolactin inhibiting factor. So if you give a dopamine agonist like a bromocriptine, cabergoline, you can relieve the symptoms of a prolactinoma. And remember, prolactinomas, almost like 100% of the time, the right answer on MBMEs is to give a dopamine agonist. Resist the temptation to give surgery, even if the person's optic chiasm is being compressed. Because the thing is, once you start those dopamine agonists, within hours to days, the tumor begins to shrink. Okay? It's only if a person fails to respond to dopamine agonist therapy, that is when you can consider transsphenoidal resection on your MBMEs. Contrast that with like pituitary adenoma that's secreting like growth hormone. Under those circumstances, your next step in management is a transsphenoidal resection. And then don't forget like your halothane, succinylcholine. Halothane is an anesthetic. Succinylcholine is a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent. Those are classically used to treat, those just know how those things work. But basically, remember that those are associated with malignant hyperthermia. And if a person has malignant hyperthermia, don't forget to give dantrolene. Okay, dantrolene basically inhibits the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and you can use it in the treatment of malignant hyperthermia. And then I talked about how you could use cyproheptadine. Cyproheptadine is it's an antihistamine with serotonin receptor blocking activity that can be used to treat serotonin syndrome. Although remember, classically on MBMEs, benzodiazepines are things you can explore first in the treatment of a serotonin syndrome. And then don't forget your benztropine and a trihexyphenidyl. These are used to treat like the some of the extrapyramidal symptoms that are observed in Parkinson's. Benztropine, trihexyphenidyl, those are muscarinic receptor antagonists. Okay, so by blocking the muscarinic receptor, you can actually use them to treat like the the acute dystonia or the Parkinsonian symptoms that are observed when a patient is taking an antipsychotic. And then remember memantine. Memantine is essentially like an anti NMDA receptor agent, right? So it blocks NMDA receptors. It's basically used in the treatment of ALS, because remember, ALS, one of the theories of ALS is this thing known as glutamate excitotoxicity. Okay, it's like when your neurons get glutamate, they get super, 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 super excited, and then that can cause destruction. I sort of think of it as like a young person goes parties too hard, and then they get into trouble and die, right? Sorry to use that morbid example, but you kind of get my point. So you can give an NMDA receptor antagonist, because glutamate acts through NMDA receptors. So if you block those NMDA receptors, you can sort of stem the tide of glutamate excitotoxicity, and you can relieve the symptoms of ALS, although it really doesn't help much. It maybe prolongs life by like 3 months or something like that. And then Ketamine. Ketamine, the big thing I want to remember is that it's like almost like things like a dissociative anesthetic. It also has a NMDA receptor blocking activity, but just think of it as a dissociative anesthetic. That's probably all I'm going to say about that. Riluzole is another drug that's used to treat Lou Gehrig's disease. It also has NMDA receptor blocking activity. And then don't forget ethosuximide. Ethosuximide is a T-type calcium channel blocker. It's classically used on NBME exams is used to treat absence seizures. Remember absence seizures and the 3 hertz spike and slow wave pattern on EEGs. Phenytoin, right? So remember phenytoin, it's an anti-epileptic drug. It's a teratogen, so you want to try to avoid it if a patient is pregnant. But if a patient has been on it and it's controlled their symptoms and they're pregnant, on NBMEs, do not stop the drug. Continue the drug. Very high yield to know that. The only anti-epileptic that you absolutely positively should stop in a pregnant woman on NBME exams is valproic acid. And remember that phenytoin, just like ethanol and aspirin, has a zero order elimination. Okay, that's more of a step one question you may see. And then don't forget a carbamazepine, right? You used to treat a tic douloureux, right? So like... by tic douloureux, I mean trigeminal neuralgia on NBME exams. Remember, carbamazepine is a teratogen. It can cause agranulocytosis. And then I already talked about valproic acid. Remember, valproic acid is hepatotoxic. They love to test that stuff on NBME exams. Valproic acid is hepatotoxic, okay? And then remember your topiramate and lamotrigine. Topiramate, lamotrigine, they are very good anti-epileptic agents. Topiramate can actually also be used for like smoking cessation, okay? But remember, topiramate has a strong association with like mental dullness, so it sort of slows down the brain, kind of like the patient say that, oh, I kind of feel slow. And remember, it has a very strong association with nephrolithiasis. And then remember, lamotrigine has a very high risk of Stevens-Johnson's syndrome. And then remember your benzodiazepine, right? Remember this mnemonic that Ben likes to have it more frequently and then Barb likes to make it last longer. Remember, benzos increase the frequency of opening of GABA receptors. And then remember your barbiturates increase the duration. Remember barbiturates, that's another nice mnemonic there. Barbiturates increase the duration of opening of GABA receptors. And remember, there's no reversal agent for barbiturates. You can reverse benzos. Benzos, classically on NBMEs, you can use them as a first-line agent. If a person comes in with a cocaine intoxication, you can actually use benzos as your first-line agent. That's one thing you can consider. And then, remember benzos, right? You can use them for like seizures. And remember, your benzos all end in PAM. And if a person has liver dysfunction, you should consider using a LOT. So your LOT benzos, right? So the L for lorazepam, the O for oxazepam, and then the T for temazepam, okay? And classically on NBME exams, there is this benzo, long-acting benzo in the hospital. Many people know it as Librium, but it's actually used in the treatment of alcohol withdrawal. It's called a chlordiazepoxide oxide. It's a very, very, very wonderful benzo for the treatment of alcohol withdrawal. And remember, you can reverse benzo toxicity with something known as flomazenil. Although one thing your friends on the NBME love to do to people is they would give you a question about a person that maybe, I don't know, like they got benzos, they got respiratory depression, and then you intubated them, right? And then they try to trick, and then they say that, oh, this person is like beginning to like thrash about and all that stuff. And then they say the next step in management, right? Don't be scared actually to give those people more benzos. They have been intubated, so it's not like they're going to like depress their respiration even more. Okay, that's one like weird thing your friends at the on the NBME love to test. And then don't forget your that you can use flomazenil to reverse benzodiazepines. And then don't forget gabapentin. Gabapentin, you want to kind of like slow down on the dose in a patient that has a renal dysfunction. And then remember that gabapentin can be used to treat a neuropathic pain on NBMEs. Same thing as a pregabalin as well. And then propofol. Remember, propofol, anesthesiologists love to refer to it as the milk of amnesia, okay? It's a very good anesthetic. Remember, it can cause respiratory depression. It can cause hypotension. And remember, there is such a thing as a propofol infusion syndrome where the person like becomes altered. They have like a lactic acidosis and all that stuff. And remember, propofol, right? If a person has a history of a familial hypertriglyceridemia, you want to go ahead and avoid propofol on an NBME exam. Remember, propofol can cause hypertriglyceridemia because it's delivered as an infusion with a lipid. And then, let's see. If a person has like history of cerebral palsy and they have like muscle spasms, you can actually give baclofen for those purposes. And then, let's see. Remember, if a person has, what is it called? If a person has opioid like toxicity, so they have like the pinpoint pupils, and then in addition to the pinpoint pupils, they have like respiratory depression, so like meiosis and respiratory depression on NBMEs, your first line agent is naloxone. They may try to trick you on an NBME by giving you naloxone and naltrexone. Careful there, pick naloxone. Before naltrexone kicks in, the patient will be dead, so you don't want that, right? So go ahead and give a naloxone under those circumstances. Naltrexone is used more for to treat them like it kind of helps with like smoking cessation. And then I remember your triptans. Your triptans are your your triptans are your serotonin receptor agonists. They can be used to treat migraines, right? They can be used to treat migraines. Although remember that you want to avoid in a person that has a history of like coronary artery disease or like Raynaud's phenomenon or like a history of stroke, right? Because remember I said that earlier that vasoconstriction is good for headaches, right? So vasoconstriction, right? If you have a history of vasospastic disease, like variant angina, so like Prinz medal angina, a triptan may not be the best idea in the world. And remember, because your triptans have serotonin receptor agonist activity, they can actually trigger serotonin syndrome, okay? So if a person is taking an SSRI, want to think twice before you put them on a triptan, on an NBME exam. And then remember, if a person has like a seizure, like what's the seizure called? A person has a cluster headache. A cluster headache, you can abort the symptoms relatively quickly with 100% oxygen. And then remember, if you give a person TPA and they are bleeding profoundly, you can go ahead and give aminocaproic acid to reverse the effects of a TPA. And then I already talked about how you can use nimodipine after an ischemic stroke. You can use it to prevent the post-stroke vasospasm. Okay. Actually, sorry, it's more, you tend to give it more after a subarachnoid hemorrhage, like a brain bleed, to prevent a post-stroke vasospasm so that the patients don't have like an ischemic stroke superimposed on top of a hemorrhagic stroke. So you can give nimodipine for those purposes. And then don't forget your VEGF inhibitors, drugs like bevacizumab and ranibizumab, right? You can use those agents to treat a wet macular degeneration. Okay, and then remember your prostaglandin analogs like latanoprost and travoprost. You can use those to treat a glaucoma. And then remember acetazolamide, it's a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. You can use it to treat central sleep apnea on NBME exams. I already explained the pathophysiology behind that in the prior podcast. You can also use acetazolamide as a diuretic, right? Remember, it has the unique cluster of side effects of a metabolic acidosis with hypokalemia. That is very unusual. Usually when you see hypokalemia, you see metabolic alkalosis with that. Or if you see hyperkalemia, you see metabolic acidosis with that. But if you see like a diuretic that has the combination of metabolic acidosis and hypokalemia, think about acetazolamide under those circumstances. And then you can also use acetazolamide, it's called Diamox in the hospital, to treat a pseudotumor cerebri. Pseudotumor cerebri is also known as idiopathic intracranial hypertension. You can also use it to treat like elevated ICPs. You can also use it to treat glaucoma. Okay, so acetazolamide is a super, super, super high yield drug for NBME exams. And then, this is not necessarily like a drug, but just don't forget your opioid, your endogenous opioid receptor agonists, right? So remember, beta endorphin attacks the mu receptors. Dynorphin attacks the kappa opioid receptors, and enkephalin goes after the delta opioid receptors. Those are things that they love to test on NBMEs. And then I already talked about your MAOIs, right? So drugs like phenelzine, tranylcypromine, and isocarboxazid. Remember, if you taking an SSRI and you're about to start these MAOIs, you need to give like a 2-week lag period on NBMEs, or else you can trigger serotonin syndrome. And remember that these drugs, you want to avoid them in people that are taking a tyramine or rich foods. And then don't forget your TCAs, remember your TCAs have an anti-HAM side effect. So they have anti-H1, anti-alpha-1, and anti-muscarinic effects, right? So the anti-H1 effects, they can cause sedation. The anti-alpha-1 effects, they can cause orthostatic hypotension. And the anti-muscarinic effects, they can cause urinary retention and they can cause delirium in the elderly. So don't forget drugs there like amitriptyline, nortriptyline, desipramine, imipramine, amoxapine, doxepine, clomipramine. Those are all TCAs. Remember, imipramine classically on NBMEs can actually be used in the treatment of nocturnal enuresis, right? Because you're effectively taking advantage of its anticholinergic activity, right? So if a kid is peeing on himself too much, right, you can sort of like relieve those symptoms by giving something that can cause a urinary retention. And then don't forget clomipramine. Clomipramine is actually one of those drugs you can use to treat OCD on NBME exams. And that's all I'm going to say about that. And remember, the other drug class that has those anti-HAM side effects, those are drugs like, they are your first generation antipsychotics, like your typical antipsychotics, but the low potency ones like clopromazine, for example. And then don't forget your SSRIs, right? So like fluoxetine, paroxetine, sertraline, fluvoxamine, citalopram, escitalopram. Remember, fluoxetine has the longest half-life of all the SSRIs, right? So it has like the least association with like SSRI discontinuation syndrome. And then don't forget your SNRIs. Remember, they cause hypertension on NBMEs, right? So don't forget like your venlafaxine, desvenlafaxine, duloxetine, milnacipran. Remember, duloxetine is classically used to treat a neuropathic pain or fibromyalgia on NBME exams. And then don't forget trazodone. Remember, trazodone can cause a big penis, right? So it can cause priapism. That's pretty much, and the way you actually treat that, because it has like alpha one or blockade activity. So if you kind of think about it this way, right, you essentially have like vasodilation of the blood vessels that feed the penis, right? So the person just has like way too much blood going there, so they just have like their thing that sort of stand on it, right? So the way you can actually treat the issues, like the priapism that's associated with trazodone, you can actually go ahead and give an alpha-1 agonist like a phenylephrine. You actually go ahead and inject it into the penis. I know it's kind of morbid, right? But you can inject it into the penis and that can relieve those symptoms. Because if you actually leave the penis like erect like that for like a long time, there's a lot of problems that can come with that. I'll let you look that up on your own online. Okay, and then don't forget mirtazapine. Mirtazapine is an alpha 2 antagonist that's used to treat depression, especially depression in an anorexic, because it causes weight gain. It also causes sedation. So if a person has depression and insomnia, mirtazapine is an awesome drug for that, because by being an alpha 2 antagonist, right, it actually increases the release of norepinephrine. Because remember, your alpha 2 receptor is a GI coupled receptor, so it's like a negative feedback for your sympathetic nervous system, so it sort of shuts down the release of norepinephrine. So if you gave something that blocked an inhibitor, right, that will actually increase the synthesis of norepinephrine. And then don't forget bupropion. It's an NDRI. It's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. You can use it to treat depression. Remember, avoid it in patients that have something that can predispose them to seizures, right? So like, let's assume they have like anorexia or they have bulimia. Those are the classic patients on NBME exams. And remember that it actually helps with weight loss and it actually helps with smoking cessation. And then clozapine, right? It's an atypical antipsychotic. Remember, it can cause myocarditis, so they can present it as a patient that recently started treatment for schizophrenia. And then now they have like an S3 heart sound. They have like crackles, like basically signs of CHF. Remember, clozapine can also cause a hypersalivation. Classically, people call that the wet pillow syndrome. And remember that clozapine is also associated with agranulocytosis. Once a person's white count begins to drop on clozapine, your next step in management is to stop the drug. Very high yield to know that. You need to stop the drug. In fact, in general, on NBMEs, if a person is having a side effect from a drug, usually the right answer, with very few exceptions, is to stop the drug. And remember that clozapine is one of two agents in psychiatry that decreases the risk of suicide. The other one is lithium. And then remember, again, I sort of mentioned this last time, but it's kind of high yield, so I'll repeat it again. Remember, of all the atypical antipsychotics, risperidone is associated with hyperprolactinemia the most. Ziprasidone prolongs the QT interval. Quetiapine is associated with cataracts, and it's the drug that you can use to treat psychosis in the certain of Parkinson's. They love to test those on NBMEs. Remember, aripiprazole is a partial dopamine receptor agonist. It's one of the most benign atypical antipsychotics. Remember, olanzapine can cause the metabolic syndrome, and you can also use it to treat OCD. Remember lithium and its tremors, right? Remember lithium, it can also cause a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. And then remember, lithium can cause a hypothyroidism, right? And the telltale sign on NBME exams of lithium toxicity is tremors. And then don't forget your Z drugs, right? So like your Zolpidem, Zaloplon, and Ezobiclone, they are used in the treatment of insomnia. They actually have a GABA receptor agonist activity. But remember that these drugs, they also actually have addictive potential. And the way you can actually reverse toxicity with these Z drugs is actually to give flumazenil. And then remember Ramelteon. Ramelteon is a melatonin receptor agonist. You can also use it to treat insomnia. I think it's maybe called Remeron in the hospital, if I'm not mistaken, or I may be wrong. But Ramelteon is the name you want to know for NBMA exams. And it really doesn't have addictive potential. And then suvorexant. Suvorexant, I believe in the hospital, is called Belsomra. Suvorexant is used to treat insomnia on NBME exams, right? So the thing is, remember, if patients have narcolepsy, they tend to have low levels of this thing. It's known as orexin or hypocretin on NBME exams. So the thing is, if an orexin deficiency in your CSF makes you sleepy, because remember, narcolepsy is a sleepy disorder, and you can kind of imagine that by giving an orexin receptor antagonist like suvorexant, you can actually go ahead and treat insomnia under those circumstances. So that's how it's tested on NBME exams. Remember buspirone, so Buspar, right? So buspirone is used on NBME exams in the treatment of anxiety. Okay, it's a partial agonist at serotonin receptors. So at 5-HT, I believe 5-HT 1A or 2A receptors, if I'm not mistaken. And then remember your drugs of abuse. Remember PCP. PCP usually shows up as a person that is like berserk, right? Like super, super, super agitated. Remember LSD usually presents as flashbacks on NBME exams. Remember marijuana, right? So like marijuana usually shows up as hunger and as conjunctival injection on NBME exams, right? So like red eye pretty much. And then remember that if a person is getting an adenosine based cardiac stress test, you want to go ahead and avoid caffeine in those people, because caffeine contains is a methyl xanthine, kind of like theophylline as well. So it kind of reverses the effects of adenosine. That's it's one of those things that you're like, Divine, that's a little too low yield. I promise you, I have taken many exams in my life. It's not a low yield factoid to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember varenicline. Varenicline is a nicotine receptor. Varenicline, in fact, mechanism of action probably doesn't matter for NBME, so I'm going to like let that go because, again, I want to make this as high yield as possible. But varenicline is classically used on NBMEs to treat smoking, like a person that's addicted to the cigarettes. Although I guess if you really wanted to know, varenicline is a nicotine receptor agonist, right? That should kind of make sense because you're using it to treat something that kind of depends on nicotine dependence. And then don't forget your methylphenidate. Remember, methylphenidate is a stimulant. You can classically use it on NBME exams to treat ADHD, right? But remember, it can cause insomnia, it can cause weight loss, it can cause anorexia. So classically on NBMEs, if you see this agent, atomoxetine is a non-stimulant drug that can be used in the treatment of ADHD. And then remember, if a person is withdrawing from alcohol, again, remember, don't forget to give them benzos. Remember aspirin on an NBME. If a person has aspirin toxicity, the classic telltale sign is the combination of a respiratory alkalosis and a metabolic acidosis. Okay. Remember aspirin, it's an irreversible inhibitor of COX-1 and COX-2. Remember, it's an antiplatelet agent. If a person comes in with chest pain, the first thing you give them is 325 milligrams of aspirin. And aspirin, right, after a person has an MI and they get like a stent in one of their coronary vessels, you place them on aspirin basically for life. And then also don't forget that on NBMEs, this is actually like floridly high yield. On NBMEs, you can actually use aspirin in the treatment of strokes, okay? In the treatment of strokes. Very, very important to know that. If a person has a stroke, on NBMEs, almost 99% of the time, the right thing to do is to give them an antiplatelet agent, either like aspirin or clopidogrel or dipyridamole. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to say about those. I already talked about the other antiplatelet agents in the first in the first round one, pretty much. Don't forget roflumilast. Roflumilast is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It's used to treat a really, really bad COPD. Remember, sildenafil is another phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It's used to treat pulmonary arterial hypertension, but it is also used to treat erectile dysfunction. And then remember desmopressin. I already talked about how you can use it to treat von Willebrand's disease because it increases the release of von Willebrand factor from our Weibo-Palladi bodies. And remember that it's also used to treat central diabetes insipidus, right? And you can also use it to treat nocturnal enuresis, although you need to be careful because desmopressin, it's an ADH receptor agonist, pretty much. It's an ADH analog. So if you're reabsorbing water in the nephron, you can get hyponatremia and get seizures with that. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then remember heparin, it's an anticoagulant. It's not an antiplatelet agent, it's an anticoagulant. Remember the association with a heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. And remember that you can reverse heparin toxicity with prodamine, okay? And remember, heparin works by activating antithrombin 3 to inhibit factors 10 and 2. Low molecular weight heparin activates antithrombin 3 to inhibit factor 10 for the most part. That's why you can, no one really does this in the real world, but you can follow low molecular weight heparin activity with a factor 10A assay. And then remember your 10 inhibitors like apixaban, rivaroxaban. Classically on MBNEs, you use those to treat HIT. So if a person has HIT, you cannot give them a heparin-containing product anymore. So your next step is to give a direct thrombin inhibitor, right? So you can use like bivalirudine, or you can use dabigatran, or you can use agatroban, or you can use a factor 10 inhibitor like apixaban and rivaroxaban. And then remember that dabigatran, right? Remember, you can actually reverse it with an agent known as idarucizumab these days. And then I already talked about warfarin and protamine sulfate and fresh frozen plasma. I talked about how these days you can actually, the first line agent, if you need immediate warfarin reversal, is something called a prothrombin complex concentrate. And then remember TPA. TPA on exams, use that to treat like strokes, right? If a person has an ischemic stroke and they come in within like 3.5 hours of the onset of symptoms, you can go ahead and give them TPA. TPA, the classic names you see on MBME exams are like alteplase, retaplase, tenecteplase. And again, remember, TPA, you can reverse its effects. If a person is like bleeding too much, you can reverse TPA by giving aminocaproic acid, or you can give a tranexamic acid. Although on MBMEs, I have seen tranexamic acid tested more in the setting of like a life-threatening like OB-GYN bleed. Because again, you're essentially giving something that prevents the ability for a person to bleed. So you can use it to treat an like a bad like delivery bleed. Like delivery OB-GYN bleed on MBME exams. And then don't forget eculizumab. Eculizumab is a C5 inhibitor. It's used to treat paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Remember that that has an association with a mutation in the PIGA gene. So you have like issues with your GPI anchors. So these people get like a bad hemolytic anemia. And remember that you can use eculizumab for that purpose. But one thing you need to keep at the back of your mind is, think about it. By giving a C5 inhibitor, you're essentially using pharmacology to induce a terminal complement component deficiency. So before a person is started on eculizumab, they need to get vaccination against against Neisseria meningitidis. Remember, people that have terminal complement component deficiencies have a high risk of recurrent Neisserial infections. And then remember hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea, it's an inhibitor of ribonucleotide reductase. Remember, it increases hemoglobin F, so you can use it to treat sickle cell disease. But remember that you can also use hydroxyurea to treat some childhood malignancies, but those are rare, like lower yield. Think of hydroxyurea for sickle cell disease on MBME exams. And then remember azathioprine and 6-mecaptopurine. Remember, they are anti-cancer agents. But one big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that these drugs are broken down by xanthine oxidase. So if a person has gout and they are being treated for cancer, right, you do absolutely positively need to slow down or like decrease the dose of azathioprine or 6-mecaptopurine so that they don't get into trouble with toxicity. Because by giving like allopurinol, for example, you inhibit xanthine oxidase, you inhibit the breakdown of azathioprine and 6-MP, and you can get a lot of issues with that. And then remember methotrexate. I already talked about methotrexate. Remember, methotrexate can cause a liver toxicity. It has multiple uses on NBMEs. You can use it to treat what is this thing called, molar pregnancy. And remember, it works by inhibiting a dihydrofolate reductase. I already talked about like the pyrimethamine and trimethoprim that are also dihydrofolate reductase inhibitors, and how if a person has like profound bone marrow suppression from a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor, you can strongly consider rescuing the bone marrow with a drug known as alugovore. And then remember the drugs that cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? So drugs like bleomycin, busulfan, amiodarone, methotrexate. Although don't forget that bleomycin works in the G2 phase of the cell cycle. It's one of those weird things you're like, oh, Divine is low yield. I promise you, it is absolutely not low yield on NBME exams. And then remember 5-fluorouracil. 5-fluorouracil inhibits the thymidylate synthase. Remember that it's an anti-cancer agent. And remember that if you give leucovorin, leucovorin actually worsens the toxicity of 5-fluorouracil. And another high yield thing to keep in mind with 5-FU, there is this drug that's used to treat come on, Divine, think. Meningitis and AIDS patients. So Cryptococcus and neoformans. Again, I apologize for this thing being kind of like random. Again, I'm literally just sitting down and spewing facts from memory. So again, I sincerely apologize. So let's get back on topic here, right? So if a person comes in, they have cryptococcal meningitis, remember, usually, right, you do like the latex particle agglutination assay to make the diagnosis. Remember, it's also positive with the India ink stain, so you have like the soap bubble pattern. If a person comes in with cryptococcal meningitis, you give amphotericin B, right? You can also give flucytosine at the same time, but after they have that issue for like a year, you actually need to place them on like 5-fluocytosine and prophylaxis. The thing is, 5-fluocytosine is actually converted by this enzyme, cytosine deaminase, to 5-FU. That's actually how it works. So I just thought I'd go ahead and throw that out there. And then I already talked about in the prior podcast, the thing is, I'm just trying to use, because it's my understanding that the first podcast, again, even like this one, is info dense. So I'm just trying to give you like a small repetition real quick on some major things I talked about then. So don't forget cyclophosphamide, right? It's an alkylating agent. It can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. You can reverse, you can prevent the bladder problems with Mesna. And then remember your busulfan, right? Busulfan is an anti-cancer agent. It can cause a pulmonary fibrosis. Remember your doxorubicin and donorubicin. Remember, those can cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy, right? Remember, those are your anthracyclines. They are classically used for breast cancer and NBME exams. Remember that these agents, they can cause, again, this dilated cardiomyopathy. And you can potentially prevent that dilated cardiomyopathy by giving a drug that inhibits the Fenton reaction. I don't know if you remember that from Pathoma. Maybe, I don't know, like studying your first year or second year or whatever. The drug that does that is a dextrozoxine. Dextrozoxine is an iron chelator. And then don't forget trastuzumab. Trastuzumab is a HER2 new blocker. It's a monoclonal antibody against HER2 new. It's used in the treatment of breast cancer that expresses that HER2 new receptor. Remember, trastuzumab can also cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, but unlike your anthracyclines, doxo and donorubicin, it causes a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy. And then remember actinomycin D, remember, on NBME exams, it is classically used in the treatment of Ewing's sarcoma. Remember that, and your 11-22 translocation. It's also used to treat pretty much like childhood cancers, right? So like Wilms tumors on NBME exams. And then remember your vincristine, vinblastine. Those are anti-cancer agents that have a very strong association with bone marrow suppression, right? Remember, vinblastine blasts your bone marrow, okay? That's a high yield thing you want to remember for your NBME exams. And then remember your paclitaxel, docetaxel. Those inhibit the depolymerization of your vinca alkaloids like vincristine, vinblastine, they inhibit the polymerization of microtubules. Your taxols inhibit the depolymerization of microtubules. Remember that your vincristine, vinblastine, they have a very strong association with peripheral neuropathy on NBME exams. If you see peripheral neuropathy in the setting of an anti-cancer drug, the one and only thing I really want you to think about is vincristine, vinblastine, because again, they kind of inhibit microtubules, right? And then don't forget your cisplatin, carboplatin, oxaliplatin. Those are also alkylating agents. Remember, cisplatin is nephrotoxic and ototoxic. You can decrease the risk of the nephrotoxicity with a drug known as imifostin. And then remember, there is this class side effect of nephrotoxicity and ototoxicity that are held by four groups of drugs on NBME exams, right? So remember cisplatin for that purpose. Remember your aminoglycosides, right? So like gentamicin, neomycin, amikacin, tobramycin, streptomycin. Remember your loop diuretics, they are also nephro and ototoxic. And also remember vancomycin. And then remember your topoisomerase inhibitors like irinotecan, topotecan, those anti-cancer agents. I remember irinotecan, topotecan tend to inhibit topoisomerase 1. Etoposide, teniposide tend to inhibit topoisomerase 2. Okay. Remember, etoposide sounds an awful lot like etuposide. So that helps you remember that it inhibits topo 2. And then there's this trick I just want you to keep at the back of your mind for the future. If you ever see a drug that ends in NEB, if a drug ends in NEB, that pretty much tells you that it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Okay, so erlotinib, dasatinib, whatever, those are all, imatinib, those are all tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And then remember the tyrosine kinase inhibitor imatinib. Remember, imatinib is used to treat CML. Remember that with your 922 translocation, Philadelphia chromosome, right, where you create the BCR-ABL fusion protein. Remember rituximab, right? Rituximab is a monoclonal antibody against CD20. It depletes your B cell population. You can use it to treat many problems, like most of these are B cell lymphomas on NBME exams. And then remember tamoxifen, raloxifen. I already talked about the key differentiating factors. Remember, those are SERMs, tamoxifen, estrogen receptor antagonist in the breast, but it's an agonist in bone, so it decreases your risk of osteoporosis, but it's also an agonist in the uterus, so it increases your risk of endometrial cancer. And then raloxifen is an estrogen receptor antagonist in bone. It's an estrogen receptor agonist in, it's an estrogen receptor antagonist in breast, so it decreases your risk of breast cancer, but not as effective as tamoxifen. It's an estrogen receptor agonist in bone, so it actually decreases your risk of osteoporosis, and it's an estrogen receptor, it has no effects on estrogen receptors in the uterus. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. And then remember that tamoxifen, right, if you're doing breast cancer chemoprophylaxis in a premenopausal woman on NBME exams, go with tamoxifen, okay? But if you're doing breast cancer chemoprophylaxis on NBME exams in a lady that is postmenopausal, go ahead and consider an aromatase inhibitor like anastrozole or letrozole or exemestane. Okay, remember, once you hit menopause, your ovaries pretty much shut down, right? So if your ovaries shut down, then you just need something that because most of your estrogen, once you're postmenopausal, comes from your adipocytes using aromatase to convert androgens to estrogens. So if you inhibited aromatase, that can help you under those circumstances. Although, another thing I want you to keep in mind is that these aromatase inhibitors, right, notice, they are dumbing down your production of estrogen. So those drugs actually increase your risk of osteoporosis. Contrast that with your tamoxifen that decreases your risk of osteoporosis. Again, you may say, Divine, these facts you're spewing, you're saying a lot of low-yield crap. I promise you, this is not low-yield crap. Again, I've tutored thousands of people, and I've taken lots of exams, and thankfully done well. These things are very, very, very high-yield to know for NBME exams. And then, don't forget your finasteride, utasteride. You use those to treat BPH in the long term, okay? In the long term, you can use those to treat a BPH, okay? Because remember that they inhibit a 5-alpha reductase, so you prevent the formation of DHT, because DHT is the thing that drives the growth of the prostate. And then remember your EPO analogs like a darbepoetin. You remember the darbepoetin, erythropoietin. You use those to treat the anemia of chronic disease associated with CKD. And then if a person has chemotherapy and they have profound bone marrow suppression and like severe neutropenia, you can actually give them a drug like theograstim or sagramostim. Remember stim, to tell you that they are stimulators of the bone marrow. Okay, stimulators of the bone marrow. They are GCSF analogs. And then don't forget this drug on Dancitron, so basically Zofran. Remember, it's a serotonin receptor antagonist. It's used to treat like chemotherapy-induced emesis. And then don't forget your neurokinin 1 receptor antagonists, right? So drugs like aprepitant, you can also use those in the treatment of chemotherapy-associated emesis. And then don't forget metoclopramide. Metoclopramide is an antipsychotic. Basically, it's a dopamine receptor antagonist. It's used to treat diabetic gastroparesis. But remember, because it has dopamine receptor blocking activity, it can actually cause extrapyramidal side effects on NBMEs. They love to test this a ton, where they present a person that's like bradykinetic, has like cognitive rigidity and all that crap, and he started like over like the last 3 months, and then they tell you that they have a history of diabetes, and then they list all their drugs for you, and then you are like, oh wait, there's metoclopramide on this drug list. So it's one of those weird things you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember all transretinoic acid, you use it to treat acute promyelocytic leukemia. Remember that that's associated with our rods, right? Remember that also, don't forget that with your 1517 translocation. And then on NBMEs, if a person has multiple myeloma, one drug you should actually keep in mind, it's one drug that never used to show up before, but it has started showing up quite a bit in recent times, is this drug known as bortezomib. Bortezomib is a proteasome inhibitor that's actually very useful in the treatment of multiple myeloma. And then don't forget your SGLT2 inhibitors, again, for diabetes, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin. Remember, by inhibiting SGLT2, you're inhibiting like a sodium glucose link transporter. So you stop reabsorbing glucose in your urine. So you essentially pee out glucose. You pee out glucose, guess what happens? Bugs love to have a great party in your urinary tract. So those drugs increase your risk of UTIs. And again, you absolutely want to avoid these drugs in patients that have a history of renal insufficiency. And then don't forget drugs like conivaptan, tolvaptan. You can use those drugs to treat SIADH. They are ADH receptor antagonists. They are super expensive. And then don't forget your mannitol. Mannitol, you can use it to treat elevated intracranial pressures. Remember, it's a non-reabsorbable sugar. Although you want to kind of avoid it in patients that have a history of CHF, because before it mobilizes stuff to your urine, right? I mean, it's not like you're injecting mannitol into the person's kidneys. No, that doesn't make zero sense, right? You inject it into the bloodstream, right? So because it's a non-reabsorbable sugar, it would increase the oncotic pressures in your vascular tree. So that can fluid overload a person that has like a history of CHF, for example. So that's one thing you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember your loop diuretics. Again, remember your loop diuretics, they cause hypocalcemia, they cause hypomagnesemia, they cause hypokalemia, they cause nephro and ototoxicity. And remember that your loop diuretics, you kind of want to maybe avoid them in a patient that has a history of nephrolithiasis, because they basically dump calcium in your urine. And remember that your loop diuretics, they all have an association with a sulfur allergy, with one exception: ethacrynic acid. Ethacrynic acid is the loop diuretic that you can give to people that have a really severe sulfur allergy. Although, of all the loop diuretics, the one that is the most nephro and ototoxic, guess what, is ethacrynic acid. Okay, so that is one high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then don't forget your thiazides, right? Remember, those work at the level of the distal convoluted tubule, unlike your loop diuretics that work at the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. Okay, your thiazide diuretics, remember, they have the strongest association with hyponatremia. Remember, your thiazides, you can use those to reduce the incidence of nephrolithiasis, because they cause hypercalcemia, and they do that by increasing the reabsorption of calcium from your urinary tract. Remember your thiazides and those hyperglucal side effects. I already talked about those in the prior podcast. And don't forget your thiazides. Your friends at the NBME, they've stopped putting HCTZ a lot, because they know everyone will get it right? Hydrochlorothiazide. How hard is that, right? So they're beginning to use other drugs like clothalidone, metolazone, and indapamide. Those are all thiazide diuretics you want to be able to recognize for an NBME exam. And then don't forget probenecid. Probenecid is used to treat gout. Remember that probenecid is a uricosuric agent, right? So it basically increases the excretion of uric acid. But this drug is very rarely used in the real world, because there are so many restrictions on its use. Before you can prescribe probenecid, the patient has to, you need to for sure know that they are under excretors of uric acid. They need to not have had tophi. They need to not have had nephrolithiasis from uric acid, like from uric acid. So it's just so many restrictions, but just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And then don't forget your aldosterone receptor antagonists, eplerenone and spironolactone. Those are used to treat the, remember, your spironolactone, right? It actually increases survival in CHF. You can use it to treat Kahn syndrome because it has aldosterone receptor blocking activity. You can use it to treat the hirsutism that's found in PCOS because in addition to blocking aldosterone receptors, it also blocks androgen receptors. And then don't forget that spironolactone can cause gynecomastia again because it has that androgen receptor blocking activity. And then another thing that it can actually, spironolactone can be used for on NBMEs is you can use it to treat chronically. You can use it to treat a person that has like elevated portal pressures and like esophageal varices. And then remember, if you want to avoid the whole shindig with, I don't know if that's even a correct term, but if you want to avoid the whole deal with the gynecomastia with spironolactone, you can give eplerenone. Eplerenone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist, but it doesn't have those androgen receptor blocking activities. And then don't forget amiloride and triamterin. Remember, those are potassium sparing diuretics. You can use them to treat the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus associated with lithium because they are INEC channel blockers. Remember that INEC channel are the principal cell of the collecting duct. So if you block that INEC channel, you basically prevent lithium from gaining access to the principal cell and wreaking havoc on the second messenger cascade of ADH. And then don't forget alescrin. Alescrin is a direct renin inhibitor. That's literally all you need to know about it. It's a diuretic. And then don't forget your ACE inhibitors, enalapril, captopril, ramipril, lisinopril. Remember, your ACE inhibitors are one of the drugs that have been shown to improve survival in the setting of CHF. Remember, your ACE inhibitors are contraindicated in people that have a history of bilateral renal artery stenosis. Okay. And remember that your ACE inhibitors, they're also contraindicated in patients that have a history of... come on, Divine, thank you, know this. They're contraindicated in people that have a history of C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency, right? So that they don't get angioedema. Right, so keep that at the back of your mind. And then remember that these are ACE inhibitors, right? They basically decrease the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, right? And remember that your ACE inhibitors, you can actually use them to treat the peripheral edema associated with your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine. Because remember, if your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they cause peripheral edema by dilating precapillary arterial, so they increase the hydrostatic pressures in your capillaries. So if you wanted to treat that peripheral edema, you can work by dilating post capillary venules with drugs like your ACE inhibitors. In fact, this is floridly high yield to know, the drug of choice, very high yield to know this, the drug of choice in the treatment of the peripheral edema associated with your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers are your ACE inhibitors. And then don't forget your ARBs, losartan, irbesartan, candesartan, telmisartan. Your ARBs, you can use those to treat hypertension. Remember, classically on NBMEs, they are pretty good if a patient has a history of dry cough from taking an ACE inhibitor. And one thing I want to go ahead and mention here is that your ACE inhibitors are phenomenal for like their renal protective effects in a patient that has a history of diabetes. And I'll go ahead and say this. This is something they can actually test on step 2 and step 3 and like medicine board exams. ACE inhibitors are not an agent to institute first for hypertension in African Americans. They just have decreased effectiveness in African Americans. The only time that you give an ACE inhibitor as an antihypertensive on NBME exams to an African American is if the African American has a history of diabetes. Because remember, your ACE inhibitors, they are renal protective because they dilate the efferent arterioles. So they basically reduce intraglomerular hypertension. And if a patient has a history of scleroderma, to treat scleroderma renal crisis, your drug of choice is an ACE inhibitor. Okay, I know I spend time on this, but this is actually like floridly high yield to know for exams. And then this drug is used to treat there's this drug known as ivabradin. So this drug known as ivabradine, remember, it inhibits the funny sodium channels. It's a great drug. It's used to treat angina. You can actually also use it to treat like heart failure that's not like super well managed with beta blockers. And again, remember, it works by inhibiting that funny channels. I describe it in more detail in terms of like hardcore pathophysiology in the cardiac pharmacology podcast. So I'm not gonna beat that horse too much. And then don't forget your class 1A antiarrhythmics, right? So your sodium channel blockers like disopyramide, quinidine, procainamide. The big one you want to remember quinidine with the synchronism. Remember procainamide as being the drug of choice for the treatment of Wolff Parkinson White. So if a person has like WPW and they have AFib, right, go ahead and give procainamide. Remember, procainamide is also associated with a drug-induced lupus, and those are antihistone antibodies. And then don't forget your class 1B antiarrhythmics. Remember, those actually shorten the duration of the action potential. So they shorten action potential duration. Drugs like lidocaine, mixolydine, and atoquinide. Unlike your class 1A, your class 1A agents, they make the QRS complex wider, right? And they increase the risk of torsade de pointe. Contrast with your class 1B, they actually, again, decrease the duration of your action potential. And then your class 1C, your flecainide and propafenone, those drugs, they can cause like QT prolongation and torsade de pointe. So you want to be careful with those agents. And remember, your class 2 antiarrhythmics are basically your beta blockers. I've talked about the beta blockers ad nauseum. I've also talked about the class 3 agents, your potassium channel blockers, right? So drugs like amiodarone, dronedarone, ibutalide, ofatidine, sotalol. One high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, though, is that sotalol, they may test, right? So you know, obviously, it's a potassium channel blocker and all that crap. But they may actually test it, you know, especially on the USMLE Step 1 exam. They love to test, like, oh, what does this antiarrhythmic do to, like, the PR interval, for example. Sotalol will be one of those class 3 agents that can prolong the PR interval, right? Because it essentially has beta blocking activity, right? So it slows conduction down your AV node. And then don't forget your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Those are your class 4 agents like verapamil, diltiazem. You can use those to treat AFib in a rate control strategy. You can use those to treat Prinzmetal metal angina. Remember, Prinzmetal metal angina these days is also known as a variant angina. And yeah, that's all I'm going to say about those. And you can actually also use them to treat cluster headaches. Okay, cluster headaches. Now, remember your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Remember, your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers are your class 4 antiarrhythmics. Your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they are used as antihypertensives. Don't forget your clavidopine. It's one of those drugs that you can actually use to treat a hypertensive like emergency or whatever. Nicardipine is also another dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker that is super, super, super useful for the treatment of hypertensive emergencies and urgencies. And remember that nifedipine is one of the antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy. And then I already talked about the post-hemorrhagic stroke vasospasm that you can try to prevent with an imodipine. It's another example of a dihydropyridine or calcium channel blocker. And then remember the dioxin. I talked about the dioxin in the prior podcast. Remember, it's a positive inotrope. You can actually use it to treat AFib because it has muscarinic receptor agonist activities, so it slows down conduction through the AV node. Remember, digoxin works by inhibiting the sodium potassium ATPase pump. Remember that digoxin hypokalemia predisposes you to digoxin toxicity, but hyperkalemia is a side effect of digoxin. Okay, I'll repeat that again. Hypokalemia predisposes you to digoxin toxicity, but hyperkalemia is a side effect of digoxin. The reasoning behind that is, you know what? Listen to my cardio podcast. I talk about that in great detail. So I'm going to keep going. And then remember magnesium. It's like a last ditch agent you can use in a really bad asthma exacerbation. And you can also use MAG to treat eclampsia. Okay, that's one thing you want to keep in mind. And then if a person has digoxin toxicity, you can treat that with anti-dig Fab fragments. And I already talked about how you can use atropine. You can use atropine to treat heart block, okay? or any like bradyarrhythmia as part of like your ACLS algorithms. And then don't forget that atropine, you can also use it to treat toxicity from organophosphates or nerve gas on NBME exams, because it's a muscarinic receptor antagonist. It speeds conduction down the AV node. And then remember hydralazine. Hydralazine, remember, this can cause orthostatic hypotension. It's an arterial vasodilator, so it decreases afterload, right? So it increases cardiac output, but it can cause a reflex tachycardia. And remember, it can also cause a peripheral edema. And then remember nitroglycerin, you can use it to treat angina on NBME exams. Remember, you don't want to give that to a patient that has that's taking like a phosphodiesterase inhibitor like sildenafil, so that they don't have an unsafe drop in blood pressure. Okay, that's kind of like the voiceover for the sildenafil ad. But anyhow, okay, back to this. And then remember nitroprusside, you can use it to treat like hypertensive emergency or urgency. Remember, it contains a crap ton of cyanide, so it can actually increase your risk for like cyanide toxicity. So you don't put people on a nitroprusside drip forever. And then remember, like your ammonitrate and sodium thiosulfate, you can actually use those to treat the cyanide toxicity on NBME exams. Because remember, ammonitrate is a powerful oxidizing agent, so it converts Fe2 plus, so ferrous iron, to Fe3 plus, or ferric iron. The ferric iron, like Fe3 plus, binds to cyanide really well. Fe2 plus does not bind to cyanide very well. Okay, so by using ammonitrate, you convert Fe2 plus to Fe3 plus, you bind up cyanide, and then the sodium thiosulfate converts the cyanide to thiocyanate, and then you can basically use that. You can basically use that to essentially like safely excrete cyanide. And then remember minoxidil and diazoxide. Minoxidil and diazoxide. Minoxidil is probably the big one you want to remember. You can use it to treat you can use it to encourage your hair growth in a man. And remember that diazoxide, it opens up that potassium channel that you find at the pancreatic islets. So you may actually see it as a drug for the treatment of insulinomas on NBME exams, because by basically giving that potassium channel opener, you basically make those cells not depolarized to squirt out insulin. Okay, diazoxide, keep it in mind, that's literally the only thing I think you will ever see on NBMEs in that context. And then remember this drug, it's known as neseritide. Neseritide is a neprilysin inhibitor. Neseritide. I feel like I'm confusing it with something else. Neseritide, it's not a neprilysin inhibitor, it's actually a BMP analog, so you can use it to treat heart failure. Remember, BMP sort of promotes diuresis, and it's also a good vasodilator. The neprilysin inhibitor I believe I'm thinking about is this drug. It starts with an S. Sacubitril. Sacubitril is a neprilysin inhibitor. Remember, neprilysin breaks down AMP and BMP. So I kind of think of it as almost like, think of like your GLP-1 agonists and your DPP-4 inhibitors. Your GLP-1 agonists, GLP-1 is broken down by dipeptidyl-peptidase 4. So if you inhibited DPP-4, you'll increase your level of GLP-1. So that's kind of like the same thing here. Yeah, I had to think about that for a second. Neseritide is a BMP analog. Well, you can decrease the breakdown of BMP by giving this drug, sacubitril. Sacubitril is a neprilysin inhibitor. And then, remember your statins, they are myotoxic, they inhibit HMG-CoA reductase. Remember that you give high-intensity statins to patients that have, I've talked about like the indications for high-intensity statin therapy in my medicine shelf review videos. It's like atorvastatin 40 milligrams, rosuvastatin 80 milligrams. Let's see. And then don't forget your PCSK9 inhibitors. Remember, PCSK9 is an agent that basically breaks down LDL receptors. So if you inhibited PCSK9, you will have less breakdown of your LDL receptors, and you will essentially express more LDL receptors on the surface of your hepatocytes, and you'll basically be able to clear more LDL from your serum. So those are drugs like alirocumab and evolocumab. They are very good inhibitors of PCSK9. And then Don't forget your anti-staphylococcal penicillin. So they cover MSSA, drugs like methicillin, nafcillin, oxacillin, and dicloxacillin. On NBM is pretty much these drugs are only used for the treatment of mastitis, okay? So that's something you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And remember that these drugs have a strong association with acute interstitial nephritis, where a patient has like fever, they have rash, and they have eosinophils that are elevated either in their blood or in their urine. And then don't forget cefazolin. Cefazolin is classically given before surgery on NBME exams. Surgeons affectionately refer to cefazolin as ANCEF. I don't know, surgeons have this ANCEF fetish, but it works really well. Antibacterial prophylaxis before a person goes for surgery. And then remember, cefazolin is a first generation cephalosporin. Remember your cefotetan, your cefoxitins, your cefiroxim. Those are second generation of cephalosporins. And then don't forget ceftriaxone. Ceftriaxone is the drug of choice in the treatment of Neisseria infections on NBM exams. Remember that ceftriaxone does not cover MRSA. It does not cover Pseudomonas. Okay. And remember that ceftriaxone can cause intrahepatic cholestasis on our NBM exams. And if you want to give, especially in like kids, right? If you want to give a person ceftriaxone on an NBM exam and they're a kid, so like a pediatric, like pediatric sepsis, you can actually give cefotaxime. Cefotaxime is a broad spectrum third generation cephalosporin that's used pretty commonly on NBM exams. Remember, the only third generation cephalosporin that covers Pseudomonas is ceftazidime. Remember, cefepime is a fourth generation cephalosporin. It also covers Pseudomonas as well. Don't forget ceftaroline. Ceftaroline is a fifth generation cephalosporin that covers MRSA. That's the high yield thing you want to know with that. Don't forget your carbapenems like imipenem, meropenem, ertapenem, and doripenem. Remember, these drugs cover Pseudomonas, okay? They cover anaerobes. They cover a crap ton of stuff. In fact, if you have an infection that is resistant to a carbapenem, that patient is in trouble, pretty much. And then, don't forget aztreonam. Aztreonam is a monobactam. It covers Pseudomonas pretty well. It is only used in the treatment of gram-negative infections. It does not cover gram-positives. Remember vancomycin. Vancomycin binds to DIALA, right? So that you don't have... basically, transpeptides needs to bind to DIALA for you to co-join the bacterial cell wall. So if you bind to DIALA, transpeptidase does not see alanine to bind to, so you don't have a building of the cell wall in bacteria. Vancomycin, remember the mechanism of resistance where you convert DIALA to DIALA-DILAC. And remember, vancomycin can cause a red band syndrome. You can treat that by giving an NSAID beforehand, or you can slow down the infusion rate of the vancomycin. And remember that vancomycin is nephron ototoxic. And remember that vancomycin only covers gram-positives. And it doesn't cover gram negatives. And remember that vancomycin covers MRSA really well. And remember that vancomycin, oral vancomycin, can be used to treat C. diff. In fact, right now, it is the first line medication for the treatment of C. diff on NBME exams, oral vancomycin. Daptomycin, remember, it basically is, it only covers gram positive organisms, also covers MRSA on NBME exams. Remember, your aminoglycosides, they cover gram negatives really well. Remember that you can use tobramycin. It's an aminoglycoside. You can use it to treat, inhale tobramycin. You can use it to prevent Pseudomonas in patients that have a cystic fibrosis. Remember that gentamicin is nephrotoxic and ototoxic. Remember, it does not cover anaerobes because it needs oxygen to be able to gain access to a cell. And then don't forget that your aminoglycosides can cause acute tubular necrosis, right? So you may see muddy brown casts in the urine of a patient that takes an aminoglycoside on NBME exams. And then don't forget your tetracyclines right here. Remember, your aminoglycoside, it's a bactericidal 30S inhibitor. Your tetracyclines are bacteriostatic 30S inhibitors. Your key tetracycline, remember, your tetracyclines are very good for zoonotic infections like Lyme disease from Borrelia burgdorferi and the Ixodes tick. They are very good for the treatment of they are very good for the treatment of like Rickettsia rickettsii and like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Although remember that your tetracyclines, you want to avoid it in a kid that's less than 80 years old. Okay. So if a person has like Lyme disease and they are less than 80 years old on NBME exams, give amoxicillin. Okay. But Rickettsia rickettsii, if a kid is less than 80 years old and they have Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Doxycycline is the drug of choice under those circumstances. Basically, if you have Rocky Mountain spotted fever, you always get doxycycline on NBME exams. The only exception to that rule is a pregnant woman. If a pregnant woman has Rocky Mountain spotted fever on an NBME exam, you give chloramphenicol. That is pretty much the only time you ever use chloramphenicol on an NBME exam. Now, remember that your tetracyclines, they can cause a photosensitivity. Remember, the way to remember that is like, there's this mnemonic. You know, I learned it when I was studying for step one. I think it's like this mnemonic, SAT for photo, to basically help you remember the agents, the drugs that are have photosensitivity as a side effect. So drugs like your sulfonamides, that's the S in SAT. Your amiodarone is also has a photosensitivity issues. And then your tetracyclines, that's the SAT for photo. That's a nice way to remember that. And then remember that your tetracyclines, they can cause like tooth discoloration. They can cause multiple issues there. Okay, and remember the demeclocycline is a tetracycline that you can actually use in the treatment of acne. Okay, demeclocycline causes nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, so you can actually use that side effect to your advantage in treating SIADH. And then remember your tetracyclines can be used to treat acne. Okay, and they're also very good for the treatment of like cholera, so like Vibrio cholerae. Okay, and then don't forget that tigecycline is a new generation tetracycline that covers MRSA. And then don't forget linezolid. Linezolid covers MRSA, covers VRE very well on NBME exams. And remember that linezolid has weak monoamine oxidase inhibitor activity, so it can cause a serotonin syndrome. And I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. This has gone on for quite long enough, so I'm really sorry, but there has to be around three. But now I can actually confidently make the promise that round three will be the last round of the Clutch Pharmacology podcast. And as I always say when I end any podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for step one, 2CK, 2CS, and step three, and the medicine in training exam, and the medicine ABIM board exam. And then if you have a college student friend that needs tutoring for biochemistry, physics, general chemistry, organic chemistry, physiology, histology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer one-on-one like consulting for those, so like application prep, application advising, personal statement writing, interview prep, and all that stuff. So I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and God bless you. I'll see you next time.